Hello, and welcome to the October episode of the Estuarine Gradient. I am Sarah Grady. I'm the Watershed Ecologist at the North and South Rivers Watershed Association and South Shore Regional Coordinator for the Massachusetts Bays Program. You can reach me at Estuarine Grady on Twitter or Sarah, S-A-R-A, at nsrwa.org, or you can also tweet at the Watershed Association at NSRWA. So today we're going to be doing a Halloween episode since it is October. And I thought that for this Halloween episode, I would bring on a friend and colleague who would be able to help me explore the world of some scary sea creatures. So I have with me here today, Niels Viggo Hobbs. He is a lecturer and researcher at the University of Rhode Island, a postdoctoral fellow with the EPA, and also the director of the Lovecraft Arts and Sciences Council.
Hello there. How are you doing, Sarah?
Good. How are you?
Good. Great to be here.
So what are you going to be for Halloween?
You know, I'm always the person that's like so busy that I always do like the last minute thing. I'm going to kind of cheat and use a big plush Cthulhu head that I have and just wear it with a tweed suit. So I'm going to be like the country squire Cthulhu.
Classy Cthulhu.
Yeah, classy Cthulhu.
Very nice. Yeah, very yeah, nice. Yeah. Well, I am going to be a Selkie.
No, very good.
Are you familiar with Selkie?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Of course. Yeah, I went to school in Scotland. So.
Oh, perfect. Yep. Perfect. Yep. Yeah. So a Selkie is a Celtic mythological creature. It's a woman who is wearing a seal skin, and she can turn into a seal. And when she emerges from the water to walk on the earth as a person, as a human, she sheds her seal skin and hides it. And if somebody happens to find it, they can make her marry them.
And or they get a very cozy suit to wear.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yep. So the Selkie is just a one example of many fantastical or mythical creatures that have sort of a real life analog. You know, when we used to make maps of the world, there were many places that were mysterious. The ocean is a particularly mysterious place. And, you know, you've heard the phrase, there be dragons. There were always these sea creatures that were illustrated on the map and the places where sailors might dare to go. And one example of these sea creatures that were real but then also mistaken for mythological creatures were oarfish. Do you know anything about oarfish?
Oh, yeah, the ones that have these remarkably long tails, right? So they just look like serpents swimming through the water. Yeah, they're amazing. They're incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but there's so many like that, you know, like narwhals and things. You imagine, mix that, mix some of the remarkable, cool, weird things that there are out in the oceans with incredibly bored sailors who are stuck on a ship for literally 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years at a time with no television, no one to talk to except their, you know, a few guys on a ship. And the stories they must invent, fueled by actual weirdness in the ocean. It's not too surprising.
Yeah. And for the people on land, occasionally things would wash up.
Yep.
And they did not know what they were. And they used their imaginations and decided that, the simplest explanation, the Occam's razor explanation, yeah, must be that these are giant monsters.
Well, which they kind of are anyway, right? I mean,
true.
Imagine seeing a blue whale wash up on, or even a humpback. I've seen a humpback whale, a couple wash up on beaches before. And especially once they're a little bit overripe, they really look pretty horrifying, you know? Especially for somebody that's never seen anything bigger than a cow.
Yeah, I was reading that when a sperm whale carcass starts to decompose in the water, that the blubber actually detaches from everything else, and the collagen starts to break down and it gets really stringy. The same thing happens to basking sharks too.
Yep.
Two big creatures that turn into nasty, tangly messes.
Nasty, tangly, and I can say the smell associated is the absolute worst smell that you will ever smell in your life.
Yes. Horrible. Yeah. I when I was in graduate school, I spent some time working for the Cape Cod Stranding Network. And most of the time it was dealing with seals, occasional dolphins, but I ended up dissecting a pilot whale once. Yeah. And it was a great coincidence because it was the same time I was a teaching fellow for a marine mammals class. So we got to bring the whole class down to dissect this pilot whale. And just the scale, I mean, a pilot whale's not the big,
amazing.
But they're pretty amazing. But you know, the smell was amplified, I think, by how large it was. We were handing out the Vicks Vapor Rub.
Yep.
Handy trick for anyone up to nefarious business involving smells. Another great sea creature that has both a mythological and real life analog is the giant squid.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, imagine chunks of that washing up around the, you know, I mean, people are like, oh, come on, there's no monsters in the ocean. And then you see this huge, long tentacle, you know, suckered arm wash up. That's pretty good evidence that there's monsters in the sea, you know?
Right. And, of course, you've seen the drawings of the Kraken engulfing the ship.
Yep. That's funny. We kind of laugh at the sailors, but they actually were kind of right, you know? Especially, I mean, at least by the worldview of people on land, you know? And plus, I imagine sailors probably wanted to make their lives sound far more exciting than they really were, so. But yeah, I get to see monsters. What do you get to see?
You just have regular animals.
Yeah, you just have regular. Yeah,
like you get attacked by a bear, maybe.
Oh, a bear. Ooh, big deal. Does a bear have tentacles? Yeah. No.
Right, exactly. I mean, a lot of it seemed, I mean, like you were saying earlier, it kind of came down to the fact that people really just didn't understand whales.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, honestly, like, a blue whale, literally the largest thing that's ever existed on the planet. I mean, you know, we have this concept of, like, a brontosaurus being this monster, and they're small, they're smaller than a blue whale. That's crazy.
You know? Have you been to the Museum of Natural History in New York?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The blue whale. Oh, my God. Yep. Yep. It definitely puts it in perspective. We're kind of little creatures.
Definitely.
Yep.
So because this is a podcast about estuaries, while I was looking through some of the mythology about the ocean, I discovered the myth of Tiamat and Abzu. Which is Babylonian creation myth. And before Tiamat became sort of this symbol of destruction, there were sort of two phases apparently in Babylonian mythology, where first Tiamat was a creator goddess and then sort of morphed into a destructive goddess. And then, of course, in the 80s became a five-headed dragon. Tiamat was the goddess of salt water, and Abzu was a god of fresh water. And so when the two commingled, I guess they created an estuary as well as the world. Mm-hmm. And I also learned that, and of course Babylon was near the Persian Gulf, which is an estuary. And I learned that country of Bahrain. Bahrain means two seas. So that was where those two seas were mixing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is kind of a very large estuary when you think about it. I like the idea of Tiamat being sort of the progenitor goddess, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's where all life comes from, is from the sea, from the oceans, you know. So that's actually kind of perfect.
Yeah.
Funny how close some god systems like that get to the truth.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about mythological creatures and what their real life analogs are. But let's talk a little bit about some real creatures that are stranger and scarier than fiction. And I'm gonna let you start with one of your favorites.
Okay. So for me, I mean, my immediate go-to for awesome creepiness, and it definitely is partly because that's what I study, but I think the reason I study it is because I've been so amazed by how weird crustaceans are. So in particular, I have a great fondness. Most of my research, my own personal research, has been done looking at crabs, but I'm really interested and then love with amphipods and isopods. So like, you know, like what they call like side swimmers or scuds or beach hoppers, and essentially the marine equivalent of like roly-poly or pill bugs, you know, isopods. I just think that they're the most amazing, creepy things that there are in the ocean. You know, with so many legs and antenna and these incredible compound eyes. And some of them have just remarkable behavior. And especially, I mostly work with, as you know, Sarah, and you've been involved with, ones that are invasive species, where there are such successful invaders that literally you'll have like a carpet full of them. You have nothing, you know, essentially a monoculture. Nothing but these little creatures crawling all over the place. And they're pretty amazing.
So what makes them so adaptable to our environment? Why can they take over so easily?
So, I mean, one of the things is they're really good. So they're obviously very tolerant of you know, physical stress and such. So especially like in an estuarine environment, you know, like here in Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, they are highly tolerant of, you know, relatively low salinities, substantial temperature changes, but they'll eat anything you put in front of them, and they are really good at reproducing. Like if you go and sample them, the females are always carrying eggs. That's actually one of the cool things about them is they brood. So unlike like crabs or lobsters that release larvae, these amphipods carry around their young with them until they're big enough to kind of crawl off on their own.
And I've always thought that animals that do that, it adds that extra level of creepiness.
It's
Like,
creepy, but it's also
it's
adorable
super
too.
cool,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's like, oh wow, the moms are so cute. They're carrying their babies
It's
around on their back like monkeys or something. Yeah, it's so cute.
amphipod
But it's awesomely creepy too. And you
Yeah.
know, these creatures have like these raptorial limbs and things.
Mm
Actually, one of them we should talk about for Halloween. I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but one of them, so, you know, people say is one of the things that helped generate the idea of Alien, the movie Alien, the xenomorphs in the movie
Oh.
Alien. It's this amphipod, it's a pelagic amphipod that lives on salps, you know, the little
Oh,
jelly ones that live
yeah.
in the water. It's called the genus is Phronema for the amphipod. And they latch onto a salp, these little like jellyfish-like creatures, and they hollow them out and lay their eggs inside of them. And then they swim around in the water column, riding on this like empty husk of this poor old salp with these huge raptorial claws, and then wait for their babies to hatch out. It's amazing. It's such a good, and they look like Alien. They look like the xenomorphs in Alien. They're pretty awesome.
And the cool thing about salps and tunicates
Yeah.
is that they're our closest invertebrate relative.
Indeed. Yeah, the salps,
Yeah.
and so salps are weird as heck as it is. I mean, they're strange enough. So, but yeah. I'll still give it to the crustaceans
Yeah, the
for extra
crustaceans
weird.
riding on the salps.
But yeah, if you want to talk about salps and jellies in
Yeah.
general, you know, I mean, salps, yeah, like you said, salps are very close relatives, despite not looking much of anything like us. But then also we have to give some love to the jellyfish for being extra weird. I think
Yeah.
you have some
Yes.
thoughts on that,
Yes, I
right?
do. Yeah. So I was thinking about how about what I felt was one of the scariest organisms. And it's something that people particularly around here are not very familiar with because we
Not
don't
yet.
really have them. Oh,
I have something to say about that.
that's
Yep.
I think that box jellyfish, cubozoans, are just kind of creepy. They have very toxic venom, and just the whole concept, when you think about how jellyfish stings work, where there are these cells that each have a trigger, these nematocysts, and that there's these tiny harpoons that come out of these cells and just inject you with venom. And they're especially toxic in Australia. Sheerneck fleckery. They are in warm water and possibly elsewhere, as
Well,
you
so
know.
we have some
Yeah.
cubozoa here. I mean, there's only 20 or 30 species of cubozoa. So this whole order of jellyfish, and there's only 20 or 30 of them, 20, 30 species. Because, you know, they're strictly pelagic, so they live in the open ocean. But we have, I think, two or three species at least of cubozoa here. But again, you know, they're probably ones that are found all over the Atlantic. The ones that are found here, though, really don't, yeah, they don't hurt humans. But of course, given, you know, global traffic and, you know, the travel of cargo ships, it could very well be that one of these days we get one. We do have a new stinging jellyfish.
Yes.
Do you know about this
yes,
one?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. Gonionemis vertens is, they call it the clinging jellyfish, because it's this. It's actually, it's a, in a different order. It's a hydrozoan cnidarian jellyfish.
So, it's more closely related to Portuguese manor.
Yeah, exactly. It's more closely, but it is a solitary animal. But it and it's called a clinging jellyfish because it clings onto eelgrass. And it likes kind of low flow estuary environments. So actually, most of the, and it stings like hell. But the only people that generally get stung by it are researchers
studying eelgrass.
That are out studying eelgrass. Like literally, there's like been, I'm gonna say maybe a couple dozen stings recorded in New England over the past 10 years or so, and all but maybe one or two have been researchers. But the sting is supposed to be unreal. It doesn't seem to pose a substantial health threat. Like nobody has died, at least according to record. But in Asia, you know, Pacific Asia, where it's native, reports of like early stings, some Russian scientists in the 60s did a study. People were so horribly stung by this that they actually were hallucinating. Like, and just like had this like sense of dread and like complete misery. And there's like, if you go onto YouTube, you can find videos of people getting stung by these things, and they look like they are having the worst day ever. And I should say day, because it actually takes days. It takes several days, not just one day, several days to recover. Yeah, and the thing is, the thing's less than a, it's like a penny in size. So that's kind of horrifying in itself. So this little thing, like all, like the cubozoa too,
right,
the box jellies, these little adorable things that will pretty much mess you up, you know?
I got stung by a Caribbean cubozoan. I was at a marine lab in Jamaica, Discovery Bay.
Oh, okay.
And we were doing a night dive. And when you do night dives and there are jellyfish around, the protocol is that you don't turn on your dive light until you are well under the surface, because they are attracted to the light.
That's not cool.
One of the creepy things about box jellyfish is that they have human-like eyes. So they have multiple photoreceptors that just are sort of telling light and dark. But then they also have these, they can direct where they're going,
which is
interesting, because you know, when you think about sort of the concept of a jellyfish, you kind of think about them kind of blobbing around.
They are
technically plankton. They're at the mercy of the currents.
Yeah.
But
I mean, jellyfish are not, you know, however you define jellyfish, most of them, you know, cnidarian jellyfish at least.
Suppose we should call them jellyfish.
I don't worry too much about those kind of pedantics. But we're talking about cnidarian jellyfish, proper. You know, scyphozoan or hydrozoan or cubozoa. Yeah. Like, there's not that. I mean, there's only two types of tissue in them, for one thing, you know. And they don't really have a nervous system. They have a diffuse nerve net. So which kind of makes the eyes, the actual legitimate eyes in the cubozoa, even weirder. Like, what are those eyes doing? Like, they're not hooked up to anything, pretty much. So it really, they're strange. They're so remarkable. And then how small they are, too. But the thing, of course, is they're really fast swimmers. They swim like, how many meters is it? Like, they can swim like a meter a second or something like that. Like,
that's fast.
A little one.
Like a little rocket.
Yeah, it's a rocket. They are incredible. But
well,
probably not quite a meter, but it's a remarkably fast rate.
The other sea creatures that tend to be the stuff of nightmares are deep sea creatures.
Vampirotuthis and all the ones that have great names, you know. Various creepy octopuses and stuff. So,
just these. You see the video from, you know, the submersibles of these things, you know, drifting around, and just everything is so eerie and glowing, and you know, and nothing needs to be able to see, so it's all.
They don't have to see, and they can't see.
Yeah.
So there's no pretense of appearance, attractive appearance. There's no charismatic megafauna whatsoever in the deep sea.
Except for maybe those giant tube worms. Those are.
Well, I mean, I love all of them. I mean, the pelagic sea cucumbers that they have, and of course the sea pig. That's one of my all time favorite animals.
Tell me more about the sea pig.
So the sea pig is a type of sea cucumber that has Podia that almost have grown to the point where they kind of look like 6 or 8 pairs of legs on the underside. And it just kind of goes along and has this like Hoover-like mouth that just suctions up goo on the bottom there. And it just sort of plods along, and it just looks like a nightmarish pig, you know, like a pig that has been horribly, horribly deformed in your worst dreams, essentially. And it's just kind of this blobby thing that is completely harmless, but it's so awesome and weird looking. I love them.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So we actually have a question from a... an avid listener.
Yay.
My second episode. My friend David wants to know, how weird could undiscovered creatures realistically get? So are there limits? You know, there's so many crazy things going on in the ocean, but are there limits on the kinds of things that could grow or live in the ocean?
Can I be a jerk first?
Yes,
be a jerk. Before I answer that?
Okay. That's fine.
So what does weird mean? Because if you think about the grand scheme of animal diversity and, like, what is commonplace, like, what's really weird are things with four appendages that kind of don't have anything else going for them. So, like, vertebrates, to me, are really kind of the weirdest thing on the planet. We just happen to be used to them. But so if you're talking about jellyfish, where there are billions and billions and billions of them, or crustacea, where literally there's 10 to 100 million species of arthropods, that's not weird at all. Those are just kind of commonplace. But, okay, so setting aside that pedantic point, there's almost no limit to really what this Earth has created. There are obviously some physical constraints, right? You know, like size is limited, especially if you're on land. But focusing on the ocean, actually, we're kind of freed from some of that. So we see, you know, a blue whale, this monster, gigantic leviathan monster, the giant squid.
So those are both soft-bodied to some degree. I mean, yep. a blue whale has obviously a skeleton. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a pen of sorts and a giant squid, but something like a crustacean.
Well, so even crustaceans, I mean, the
snow
Alaska,
crabs.
Yeah, snow crab, Opelionis, like they get, what, 10 or 12 feet across in leg span? I think there's some that are even a little bit bigger than that. That's bigger than, like, you know, that's as big as, like, your living room across if they stretched out their legs. You know, that's nuts. Of course, the thing is, I mean, as I'm sure you know, snow crabs are related to spider crabs, who are the most timid, docile things. That being said, a snow crab, I sure as hell wouldn't want to get pinched by one, because even though they're relatively... simply the size of the claw is going to hurt like a son of a gun. But yeah, I mean, in the ocean, like, you see, you know, gigantism happen, especially in colder and deeper waters, so like the Southern Ocean, and deeper waters where they have like the large isopods.
Seen the pictures.
I'm gonna forget the genus, Bathy Pelagia. No, what is it? Anyway, the ones, yeah, they get to be like, you know, 14 or 16 inches long.
Like a puppy.
Yeah, they look like an adorable puppy if your adorable puppy had huge compound eyes and, you know, 20 segments and 7 pairs of legs. You know, yes, that's my kind of puppy. I should get one of those.
But an iso puppy.
An iso puppy. Oh my god. Can we do that? That's like a labradoodle, but way cooler. But yeah, I mean, honestly, like, in terms of physical constraints, there's not that much. Like, there's a species of jellyfish that's native to New England. We have it here in Rhode Island, the lion's mane jellyfish, Cyanea capillata. The fully grown adults in the northern Atlantic, the far northern Atlantic, like, the bell gets, I think, a meter or more across. And they have tentacles that hang down 20 or 30 meters. I mean, literally, they are a contender for the largest animals on the planet. I mean, they're huge. And that's a jellyfish. I mean, there's, you know, effectively no constraint. You know, there's some point they probably just start to die, you know.
But... Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Alien.
Yes.
And the inspiration for Alien being this amphipod that rhymes on the salt. But obviously, there is a lot of great inspiration for horror and sci-fi I mean, at the most basic level, Jaws.
Of course, yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, like, the thing I'm always kind of disappointed with, like, horror and sci-fi, and one of the reasons why I really like authors like, say, Lovecraft, who, his creatures that he used were so much more weird and horrifying than kind of the standard man wearing a weird mask, you know, or just like a ghost or something like that. Like, creatures that have multiple limbs and pseudopods and more eyes than you can count. That's more reflective of, like, what we see just as commonplace animals. Like, a scallop has, you know, dozens of eyes on it. Cubozoan, the box jellies have dozens of eyes on them. And tentacles.
Horseshoe crabs have 9 eyes.
And yeah, I mean, like, you know, like an average animal, just a commonplace, boring animal in the ocean is way weirder than most of what Hollywood develops, you know?
Right.
So I'm always kind of psyched when I see a good horror movie or sci-fi movie. That's what I look for. Is yeah. Good stuff like that.
There was a big rash of ocean-based, some may say terrible, some may say wonderful.
Oh, bring it all.
Sci-fi movies that came out in like the late 80s or 90s. So let's see. Deep Star 6. Have you ever seen?
Oh yeah, of course. I've probably seen all of these movies probably multiple times. Even the really bad ones.
Yeah.
Still see them.
So Deep Star 6 featured a Eurypterid.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. So a Eurypterid is a sea scorpion, and it's related to horseshoe crabs. They're both myristomates, which means that they had mouths in the middle of their legs. So if you flip over a horseshoe crab and you know, you're looking for a horseshoe crab mouth, it's this this hole that's filled with spikes.
Yes.
And as the crab walks, it's able to grind up its food. But Eurypterids are now extinct, but they roamed the ancient oceans. And I was actually just in Vienna, Austria, and I went to the Museum of Natural History there, and they had some really fantastic Eurypterid fossils.
Fossils, cool.
Nice. And the thing about them is that when we're so used to seeing that sort of elongated crustacean-ish, not a crustacean, you know, being something that's small, right? Mm-hmm. And even like a large lobster mm-hmm. is still smaller than the Eurypterids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that's a good
And they're cool, too, because they're, I've been thinking about Eurypterids a lot lately because I'm teaching a class on evolution right now, and Eurypterids, for me, are cool because they're kind of considered to be sort of transitional forms from marine to land. So sea scorpions are thought to be at least similar to, and the fossil record kind of bears that out, that they're some of the very first animals to migrate onto land, which is pretty awesome. So imagine those things crawling up onto the beaches.
Yeah, when everyone thinks about that big step from the ocean to the land, they're not imagining.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, they always focus on, like, you know, the first fish to crawl. Come on, let's go back a couple hundred million years or something like that. Look at really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. How about Deep Shock?
I don't know Deep Shock. Uh-oh. Is it on Netflix?
Write
this down.
So this is just kind of random list of things I found. But so that one was all about electric eels.
Oh, of course.
Of course. So that's another thing that people find terrifying.
Yeah,
in the ocean.
It's
I mean,
kind of terrifying.
Fish and skates, things that can create torpedo rays.
Right.
You know, that can create an electric current.
People are so easily frightened of the ocean, though. It's so funny. It really doesn't take much. Like, literally, you have the first fatality of from a shark in 80 years, and people are like, oh my God, can't go near the ocean, you know. But of course, I'm sure they probably run home and watch Jaws right away. I can't blame them for it, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you think about all of the dangerous things we do on a daily
exactly.
basis...
Exactly. Well, like, the chances of you dying in a car accident on the way to or from the beach are far greater than chance of even getting a little nick from some sea creature, you know? But anyway.
But in a lot of cases, it's, you know, it's a fear of the unknown.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know, I do a lot of open water swimming. And in many cases, you know, I mean, certainly around here, even, you don't have to go very far to not be able to see what's ahead of you or below you.
What's below you,
You know, and people do not like that feeling. People don't like knowing that there are things underneath them. Which is why it's always interesting when people get a chance to go scuba diving for the first time. Because I think at the same time that you're overcoming sort of maybe the fear of diving itself and that some people get a little claustrophobic, but also just getting down to the bottom and seeing, oh, this was a bunch of, you know, there's some rocks and there's some algae, you know, there's some fish swimming around.
Unless you do like pelagic diving.
Well, yeah.
Because you're looking down and it's just black, just the abyss below.
Yeah. The only time I ever did something like that was, again, I was in Jamaica and we went diving off of the continental shelf.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very close down in the Caribbean. And it was just a wall. It was there wasn't a bottom. It was just vertical. I think I spent more time looking at my depth gauge.
Oh,
than
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. You can start get a, that's when you kind of start to get a little paranoid about it. That's for sure. Yeah.
Like, how am I just going to slowly sink to the bottom? One of my favorite sort of ocean based movies, sort of from that era, is The Abyss.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. The Abyss is a great movie. It's so good. And so imaginative. It's like one of the few, you know, where it's like, wow, it's like the water is actually a creature unto itself.
Yeah. You know, awesome. And I like the tenophore, you know, in the end, it's like these giant tenophores.
So that's what I was going to mention. One of my favorite, and kind of going back to the question that we received, like, what are the constraints? Like, how what is the weirdest thing? I always want to think about what life is like on other planets, right? And, you know, especially aquatic life, which is probably, you know, very likely to be where other life would rise, just like it did here. There's a great movie that came out a few years ago called Europa Report. You ever see that movie?
No.
Oh, you have to see it. It is legit good. It's kind of low budget, but it's quality sci-fi horror, and it's about an expedition going to Europa to kind of plot, you know, what the moon is like and what life, you know, they find evidence of life on the moon. And I don't want to give away too much, but the life that I find ends up being highly identifiable as comparably weird to what we have on the planet here. Yeah. So, but yeah, you think about things like tenophores, and those are people who don't know what a tenophore is, these things called cone jellies, they might actually be a contender. They probably come the closest for me to beating out crustaceans for awesome, beautiful, weird things. These animals, these jelly animals that have these rows of little fine hairs, cilia on their body, they use to move with, and they make these incredible, like, iridescent colors as those teens, these comb-like things are moving. And then some of them also bioluminesce, like the ones here have these great green bioluminescence at night. And they're awesome, so weird, beautiful. And again, it kind of makes me like, come on, Hollywood, you can do better than this, you know?
Yeah. But I almost studied tenophores.
Did you?
Yeah.
It's not too late.
I know. It's never too late.
You go from arthropods to tenophores.
So I was out in Friday Harbor in the San Juan Islands, and you know, that's another place where the water's cold and you get these really huge marine organisms. And so I decided to maybe study tenophores when I was out there because there was someone who worked out there, but in addition, there's these huge sea stars. Like Pycnopodia, which is the sun star. And they're just these big discs with like 20
arms.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, even like the Pisaster, the standard five arm star there is like almost a foot across or something like that. It's like twice as big as the ones around here. Everything grows bigger there. So the one I was going to mention before also was Pycnogonids, the ones, little sea spiders. So sea spiders are these little arthropods that, I say little because the ones I'm used to, I went on an expedition to Hawaii for a couple of weeks and had to hunt down Pycnogonids, and there's these creepy little things. They're more leg than anything else, but they're only like the size of your fingernail. But in the Southern Ocean, again, like everything, they're monstrous. They get like big, like twice as big as your hand spread out, and they're just these awesome things that I always imagine like crawling around on top of your head or something like that when you're diving. But but yeah, but again, that, you know, there's not that much constraint physically once you're in the ocean. You know, like lobster. Oh, by the way, we didn't even talk about lobsters.
No.
You know, lobsters, we think of lobsters being, you know, maybe a foot long or something like that. But, like, there are deeper water lobsters that, you know, we're not even sure how old they can get. You know, they have kind of semi-indeterminate growth. And they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, maybe it takes longer between molts. But, I mean, we have, like, lobster claws in the collection at the University of Rhode Island that are bigger than most lobsters that you'd buy at a restaurant. Just the claw alone.
Yeah.
You know, imagine running into that.
I had heard that the lobsters, when they, you know, obviously if we're not harvesting them and eating them and they're just left to their own devices, that they die because they get just so big that they can't physically molt anymore.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be actually the kind of the final constraint, is simply just the process of molting is too exhausting. You know, otherwise, yeah. I mean, so it's not even size. It's not size that stops them.
It's like when you come home after a long day and you're just like, I'm just going to sleep in my clothes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's been recent work thinking. That's literally where it starts to fall apart. And then also, you know, sort of replication of genes over time seems to probably wear down.
No, of course.
You know, like aging, essentially.
Right.
You know,
So, The last movie that I had written down is Dagon.
Oh, nice. Okay. good.
So, what do you have to say about Dagon?
So Dagon...
the movie, and then we can...
Yeah. So Dagon, for those of you who don't know, is based on an H.P. Lovecraft story. It's made by probably the most famous Lovecraft filmmaker, Stuart Gordon, who's a friend of mine. He was a guest of ours at Lovecraft Arts and Sciences years ago. He's famous for making the movie Reanimator, which is not a very good movie. It's almost unbearably... I don't know, schmaltzy and gory and such, but Dagon is actually really, I like it a lot. I think it's pretty awesome, and it's kind of close to the story that Lovecraft wrote called The Shadow of Rittensmouth. But it ends, you know, basically it's the story about this town that's kind of devoted itself to the darker side of the oceans, worshipping the dark gods of the ocean. And I think the name, you know, Lovecraft actually probably originally took the name from the old Babylonian god, Dagon, which I don't think is nearly as horrifying as what he was envisioning. But.
So what did Dagon theoretically look like?
Wasn't he was like half man and half, was it like toad or something like that? Or fish, right? Half man, half fish, right?
Is that then that's different from the deep ones?
Yeah, so that's similar to Lovecraft's creatures, the deep ones, that are, these like weird human fish hybrid kind of a thing. So they're actually their own creature, their own species entirely. But then they do hybridize with humans, which of course is where the horror of much of that fiction comes from. And that's what Dagon the movie is kind of about. This town that sort of devoted itself a little too much to its old fishing ways.
And a lot of the coastal horror of Lovecraft was, you know, based in this area.
Oh yeah. Yep. And funny enough, Lovecraft apparently was rather terrified of the ocean and hated seafood. And so I think he was just expressing, like he did, you know, for good and bad, for most of his horror fiction. It was like him expressing his fears and phobias of all sorts of things around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, his fear of the ocean definitely infuses a lot in his stories.
Yeah, I know a couple of people who have shellfish allergies that definitely adds to their... Although I was wondering, and I think I asked you this actually this summer when we were doing our invasive species surveys, about whether amphipods could could hurt someone who had shellfish allergies.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
I think you'd have to eat quite an awful lot of them, probably. I don't know. But
you go swimming in the ocean.
I mean, that's probably the only legitimate reason I can think of to actually have some fear of sea creatures, is if you're allergic to them, you're going to go into anaphylactic shock.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, any other fear is probably a little bit absurd. But,
mm-hmm.
But it's still fun. Fear is fun. I like fear.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. It's just, a good, you know, good Halloween topic. Yeah, exactly. So, of course... The primary and most famous Lovecraft creature Has some roots in aquatic or marine organisms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Would you like to talk about Cthulhu?
Great, my heart, Lord and Savior, Cthulhu. I mean, this Lovecraft creature. Honestly, like, Cthulhu is probably Lovecraft's most famous creature, but he's also kind of his most humdrum. It's almost like a manlike. He's got two arms and two legs, even though they have huge claws on them. But then he also has wings, you know. So he's kind of, or maybe griffin-like. But then, of course, the most impressive thing that everyone kept, you know, copies is this huge octopus-like head with all these tentacles and, you know, suckered arms and such. And the greatest thing about him is he basically has been on Earth for millennia, but sleeping at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, waiting for stupid humans to make him rise from the depths.
And because of his relative fame compared to some of the other mm-hmm. Lovecraft creatures, and like you said, he's sort of semi-humanoid, yeah. or at least recognizable.
Unlike most of Lovecraft's creatures, we can actually kind of identify and relate to him because he sort of looks like a creature, you know, with limbs.
Yeah,
you know?
And we're currently sitting in the Lovecraft Arts and Sciences store here.
Yep.
And next to us are children's books, like C is for Cthulhu yep. and Sweet Dreams Cthulhu, which are, you know, fun cartoons of Cthulhu. So yep. certainly a lot easier to translate into a more benevolent form
mm-hmm.
than some of his peers.
We're habituating the next generation.
Yeah, we, us. Yes, yeah.
Yep. So but, then when Cthulhu finally rises from the depths, waking from his slumber, he won't be as terrifying as he subjugates us all. That's right, yeah, big deal.
Yeah.
I kind of just like the general idea of thinking about the ocean as this unknown, this great unknown. Like you said, like, you know, like kind of fear of the unknown. That's almost, it's actually a Lovecraft quote, you know, the great, oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest fear is fear of the unknown. And if you think about, like, how little we know of the world's oceans, I think we've only, what, researched 3 or 4%, they say, of the world's oceans. The vast majority of it is completely unexplored. There are creatures out there that we probably still have yet to discover. You know, that, to me, is pretty exciting and a little bit creepy, but in a good, you know, exciting way.
Yeah. So I hope that you have a very happy or scary Halloween, whichever.
Yes.
Both.
Yes. I'm going to have to watch some good scary sea creature movies now.
Oh, yeah.
You have to watch Europa Report. And I'll watch, wait, which one am I watching?
You're gonna watch Deep Shock.
Deep Shock, okay. All right.
So that's our homework.
Yes,
We'll have to report back to each other on that
Perfect.
One.
Perfect. Awesome.
All right, so this concludes the October Halloween episode of The Estuarine Gradient. I am Sarah Grady, the host of The Estuarine Gradient. We've been joined today by Niels Biggo Hobbs. You can send in your subject ideas or questions to me, sarah@nswa.org. Or you can reach me on Twitter at @EstuarineGrady. Or you can also just tweet at the NSRWA, @NSRWA. Thank you for joining us.